people have written books that stick on it. And obviously it does tend to capture people's imagination when they see this apparent altruism within the colonies, because effectively you could be a worker, be raising the young from another father. So why are you doing that? Is a good question.
Yep.
I want to know something about the scale of the dying of honeybees. You mentioned that lots of hives have died off because of this or that. Presumably, hives do die off if there's tens of thousands of them. There's a kind of natural cycle. We hear a lot of very alarmist things about them. You know, what is the scale of it? And should we all be panicking, as sometimes is suggested, and signing petitions and all the rest of it?
It's a good question. I guess that would be a good question. There's a difference between large-scale colony losses and population declines. Okay, so and we have to clarify that. We have to clarify that it's possible to double the number of colonies in the summer. Okay, so if we have 30% dying in the winter, we probably have 15% dying through the year, and we may still end up with a surplus of colonies in the long run. And actually, when it comes to managed colonies, there are countries where we've seen proper declines in the managed colony population. Okay, so we've seen declines in North America because of something called colony collapse disorder, which you may or may not have heard of, being one of the drivers. There's lots of reasons why they might be losing their bees, but that's one of the drivers. And that got in the news a lot, and that captured the public's imagination. But we don't have that particular syndrome. It's a syndrome which has certain symptomatology associated with it, and we don't have that here. Okay, so that's one of the pressures we don't have to worry about here yet. And so that did actually cause some genuine reduction in the population. Okay, we've also seen some genuine reduction in the population in Portugal and Spain. We've seen some general reduction in the population across Europe as well over the last 14 years. And that's not necessarily down to individual things. The main reason is that there are fewer beekeepers. Okay, that's something which will drive a managed population's in numbers down, is if we have fewer beekeepers, there'll be fewer hives. Okay, so there are things which have definitely reduced. We saw a massive reduction in beekeepers, for example, when Veromite came in, because lots of people went, I'm not going to do this, it's too hard, or it's too difficult, or I'm losing too many bees, it's not commercially viable. So we lost a lot of beekeepers, and as such, we lost a lot of colonies that were never replaced, that population had actually moved down. Okay, so it's a good question. And when you see in the papers, are we talking about population declines or are we talking about colony losses? Okay.
You were saying about bees actually dying of starvation, and also the beekeepers were still taking half of the honey. I thought bees, were supplemented with some sort of sugary solution or something to keep them going.
They are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how did they starve then?
Well, the reason that they would have starved is because the beekeeper may have taken some honey. In some cases, it may just have been a region which didn't produce honey at all. And there's if you read a book on beekeeping, it will tell you when you should think about supplementary feeding of your colonies, and it will tell you you need to start thinking about that in the autumn. Okay, and the difference with 2008 was that the nectar dearth came much earlier, and that meant that if people were reading a book saying, "Oh yeah, well I'll do what I did last year," and actually the colonies had run out and some of them starved. It wasn't mass, but it was certainly a cause of some colony losses in 2008. So it's a management problem, and I think it's the difference between having the experience to manage them based on what you're seeing and manage them based on what you're reading.
So there are signs?
Yes. And the signs are, for beekeepers here, you start to see lethargy, okay, in your bees. Your bees actually start moving more slowly on the frame. You sometimes see some of them sort of roll off as you look at them. And so that's actually a sign that they're starving. There's obviously very light colonies, very few stores left on those frames. And it's possible, even if you've got a colony which is starving, it's possible to recover them. You've just got to know the right management techniques to do it.
Okay.
Sarah, in these isolated communities, where does genetic diversity come from?
It's a good question. What we would say, if we were to plot the whole apiary network of England and Wales that we know about from the bee unit across a map, you would actually see that the apiary network in some places, particularly people tend to keep bees where they live, and so the bee population tends to be very much located, co-located with the human population. And actually, there aren't so many islands, there aren't so many regions in England and Wales where bees can't move through an apiary network to get to different places, okay? So that's one thing, is that there isn't that great deal of isolation. The second answer to the question is that because we have a lot of bees coming into the country each year, and say we have 10, 14,000 different queens coming in, the queens are going to be the egg layers, they're going to be bringing their genetics with them, and they scatter themselves around the country, okay, and then the next year you'll get some more communities around the country. And so in England and Wales, we have a fantastic genetic diversity within our honeybee population, and we're very unlikely to see declines because of sort of inbreeding or poor genetic selection. What they do have, they have a problem in the States, because in the States they have just a few queen breeders that supply a lot of colonies to their beekeeping population. So they have just very few breeders with very low genetic diversity, and that represents, because they have certain bans on where they can get their material imported from. And so the Americans have realised actually that might be a problem, and might be one of the reasons why their honeybee populations aren't very robust to change, or to things changing in the environment. And so they're starting to import semen from abroad to try to increase the diversity of their breeding stocks. Okay, it's not a problem here, but in the States it has been.
I've often wondered whether radio waves might have influenced bees. We're obviously pumping out radio waves a lot more now with phones and everything else, TVs and so on. And I would just imagine it might affect their navigation, or there must be something that might affect them from that.
There's no good evidence for that yet, but then the forms of radiation emission that we as a population put out there is changing all the time. So some of the smart meter systems that are in your homes now, some of the water meters, the smart meters, they're using different sorts of radiation than phones, so and they might be more powerful, they might be different wavelengths, and I think that I think it's unlikely, but I think it's one of those things that's actually a bit of a data gap. I think it's that people probably haven't had a good look at that.
How would it show up?
How would it show up? Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess you'd have to set up an experiment to see whether, if you had one of these things in a hive, you had fewer bees returning. So I guess you could look at returning, or you could look at rearing behaviours, or changes in behaviour within the hive. but you'd have to set up an experiment to look at that. And I'm not sure that anyone really has.
Your next project, maybe?
It might. I've got a few other ones.
Okay, I've got two questions. The more interesting one is, I was wondering what your opinion on the surviving of wild bees, feral colonies, is, because some people seem to think there aren't any left to speak of. But if you talk to anybody who works in the woods, they say, oh yeah, I was doing tree management and I came across a lot of nesting bees. It wasn't nesting, it was definitely bees. Mm.
So for those of you who aren't beekeepers, I've told you all about managed honeybees, but we actually had, until 1992, a very large population of feral colonies. So we had this population of honeybees in this country that weren't managed. They were effectively wild. They did their own thing. We imported this little darling, and as such, their populations were said to crash. Actually, there wasn't any good evidence collected on that, because it's very difficult evidence to collect. So you can't look in the literature and find the actual papers that show you what the reduction in the feral population was, but from talking to so many people, there was a vast reduction in the feral population. And so one of my PhD students over the last 3 or 4 years has been interested in trying to find out whether the feral population is still around, and whether the genetics of that feral population are significantly different from the managed population. and they're not. Okay, so what it looks like is the feral population that we have now are escapees from the managed population, which is interesting, and it's likely that this mite and its associated viruses are causing the feral population issues. Okay, so does that answer the question? Yeah?
The gentleman said you had two questions. You probably answer one wrong.
Yes, my other question, which is a bit more specialist, is can you tell us, it's said that bees will be reclassified as domestic animals in a couple of years. I was wondering what the implications of that were for beekeepers.
Okay, it's a good question. There's always changes in there's always two levels of changes in policy. So I'm a government scientist, but I work for an arm's length agency. So I provide independent evidence to government, and then they make policies, sometimes based on the evidence, sometimes not. And that's their choice, and I don't comment on that publicly, because I'm an independent government scientist. And so there are rules and laws that are made in this country, and then there are rules and laws that we all know are made in the European Union, okay? And what this gentleman's referring to, I think, is that there's currently under discussion a new European Union legislation that would classify honeybees as livestock, okay, and put them in the same animal welfare bill as sheep and cattle. Okay. Now, if they do that, and I don't know whether they will do that, it's still not been decided. If they do that, then any member state that doesn't keep a register of keepers of those animals will be fined by the EU. So we will then become obliged to know where all the beekeepers are. And currently we think, through a voluntary scheme of having people come and talk to us, we think that we've got something like 67% of the beekeepers out there. Okay. But what this would do, it would be legislation coming in that would mean that those people that didn't want any contact with the government but wanted to keep bees would be fined if they didn't tell us where they were. Okay. But that's not... It's not a UK drive, it's an EU drive. And it's a system that's been running in New Zealand. And what they found in New Zealand is they knew something like 85% of the beekeepers, but even with legislation in place to have a national register, they still didn't know about 15% of beekeepers. And that's why they weren't able to control the varroa mite when that arrived on their shores a few years ago. Because they suddenly realised that all these beekeepers they didn't know about, regardless of the $5,000 fines or whatever it is they had, not registering. Okay,
come over there, in the front, in the middle.
How do bees navigate?
How do bees navigate? It's a good question.
How does anything navigate?
Okay, so bees will find a resource. So the way I try to explain it, I mentioned earlier this is a superorganism in a box, okay? And what they have is they have the ability to find resource, and then they're recruitment foragers. So an individual forager, scout, will find something nice 2 miles in that direction, and then they'll come back and they'll do a little dance, okay? And they'll do the little dance, and they'll the more vigorous they do the dance, they're telling those around them, this is really good, okay? Yeah, it's a bit like a Saturday night in the student union bar or something. But the more vigorous the dance, the better the resource. And then they dance in a certain angle, which shows the angle to the sun, which direction to fly. And then, so they use their vision quite
so
a lot.
They use the sun?
Yeah, they use their vision quite a lot. They've got very... Which way around is it? They're sensitive to... They're sensitive to... Is it blue light or red light? The beekeeper in here. Which
blue
way around is it?
Blue or red?
Yeah, so they're more sensitive to blue and purple.
They see
ultraviolet. But they don't see infrared very well. So we've got better infrared vision than red vision than they've got. Okay. So if you look at a flower with a UV lamp, that's how a bee sees it. Okay, and often you have these landing strips on the flowers that you can't see, but when you put a UV light on it, you have these... So it's almost like an airport, you know, when you're coming into land and you've got all the lights. It's like the landing lights at an airport for the bees. Okay.
Is there any evidence that they're sensitive to the magnetic field of the Earth?
Yes. Yes, there is.
If you didn't hear that, that's their sensitive to the magnetic field of the Earth.
Yeah, there is some evidence on that.
Polarity as well.
I'm not sure.
What's it called?
the angle of the sun.
Oh, it's a day. Angle of dawn.
Yes. Yeah, they can do that, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I'm not a specialist on their senses. I'm straying away from my area of comfort.
You said there'd been quite a loss of bee species. Is that due to the just being weak, or perhaps due to the displacement due to the managed bees?
Well, it's another good question. So displacement and competition is something that people talk a lot about, but actually there's very little evidence that honeybee colonies provide such competition that they displace native wild pollinators. I know several academics that are very interested in the welfare of the wild pollinator community, and they've run several experiments at sites. So there's certain sites where beekeepers will move their bees to at certain times of the year to get crop. Okay, one of the sites is Yorkshire Moors. Up near Rose, there's lots of heather there, they get heather honey. Heather honey has a value, so they take their bees up there, and it gives us all sorts of interesting disease issues, but they collect the honey. And so the academics from Leeds University, they've looked into this. They have some students up there seeing how much it affects the local pollinator community, because you've effectively got local pollinators without honeybees, followed by local pollinators with honeybees, followed by local pollinators without honeybees, and they can't find any. The reason you don't see it published is they can't find the evidence. It would go in the Journal of Null Results to suggest that there's competition there. So I don't think that's necessarily an issue. However, if we carry on, perhaps with agricultural intensification has an unfortunate side effect in that it reduces floral diversity. If we carry on intensifying our agriculture, if we carry on doing that, there might come a point where they do start to compete.
Is there any evidence of that in America already? Because they tend to be much more intensive than we are.
I've not seen anything, no. I've not seen anything. I'm not sure whether I've not seen anything again because they've not done the work or they didn't find an interesting result. I'm not sure. But I've not seen anything, no.
Sarah, can you go to the chapel middle? Yeah?
Thank you. You mentioned New Zealand. Can you say something about Manuka honey and the whole story of...
Well, the story of an incredible sales pitch. I could. I mean, they do have active components in the honey. That's true. But there are also native honeys here that have active components in them. It's just that we don't necessarily market the stuff the same way. What I do know about the New Zealand honey situation is that we actually import more Manuka honey just in this country than New Zealand export. Okay. Now, if I tell you that the cost of honey from China is something like a hundredth of the cost of honey of Manuka honey, then I think there's a bit of mixing goes on. Okay, so there's actually a labelling issue there, and if you look on, there's a guy who works at our place called Adrian Charlton, and there are certain things, and I can't remember what they are. There's loads of acronyms they use for their honeys, and some of them are absolute nonsense, and they're the ones you've got to watch out for, because some of them are real, okay, and that would justify the cost, and other ones aren't. And so there's a real labelling issue with New Zealand honey, and I think you're worth looking him up, actually, and looking at what the stuff to look out for is. There's, I can't remember what the acronyms are, it'll probably come to me later on, but I can't quite remember. But yeah, there's something funny going on there.
Can you just say, when you said active ingredients, you mean active components, you mean antibacterial, antibiotic?
Yeah, antimicrobial compounds that as a result of the honey being derived from Manuka. But we can get, so they do these clearance zones. So you have an agar plate and you seed it with bacteria, put a drop of honey on and you see what the inhibition zone of inhibition is around the drop of honey. And actually, some of the native honeys that we produce here are pretty good. We're just not very good at marketing it. Anyway, this is worth about £100 to you, sir.
I've read that bees which tend to be resistant to disease also tend to be more aggressive and are more likely to sting. Is that true? And does that mean that bees are getting... more likely to sting people,
they're beekeepers? So, no is the answer. No, it's not correlated So aggression and productivity, it's not correlated. Aggression and disease resistance, it's not correlated. I think what happens with aggression is there's a native bee that we have here, Apis mellifera and mellifera. So Apis mellifera is the honeybee. Apis means, it's Latin for bee. Mellifera means honey carrying, honey making bee. And there's loads of different races of Apis mellifera around Europe. Okay, so it's been in different environments for long enough to change its colour, to change its size, to change its hair length. There's lots of interesting evolutionary changes that have occurred in these different sort of local adaptation going on. Okay, and sometimes what happens is you get this bee that looks black is a bee that's deemed to be Apis mellifera mellifera by beekeepers. Because it's a black bee, it's a native black bee. And what can happen is you can get hybridization between the native bee and a non-local type. And they can be quite jumpy, they can be quite aggressive. But the overriding colour of them over time is black, because that's the colour that our environment, you know, tends to, it's cool here, they need to be a dark colour to absorb the, you know, be able to fly at lower temperatures and absorb the sun's rays. So they tend to start to turn dark, and then the local bees, the Apis mellifera bees, get kind of a bit of a bad rep, because, oh, they're black and they jump up at you when you go near them. But actually, it's not necessarily Apis mellifera mellifera, but it's probably some sort of hybrid that's doing that.
What would a bee find stressful? I mean, apart from malnutrition, and what would be the consequences of that?
Okay, so nutritional stress can affect a bee's ability to respond to disease. So you've got nutritional stress. I mean, I don't know how much evidence there's. A lot of talk about in North America the moving of bees, large-scale moving of bees being stressful. I don't know how much truth there is and how much evidence there is out there. How else can you stress a bee? Periods of queenlessness might stress the colony. I don't know how else you stress them. I suppose there's chemical stresses. There could be chemicals in the environment that might stress them. Hornets are all right, actually. You don't have to worry too much about hornets. Hornets will take... I passed two round. The one that's not here yet is bad. The one that's here already does predate honeybees already, but it doesn't take very many of them. It doesn't tend to take hundreds and hundreds of individuals from a colony, unlike the one that's coming in. So it's a very low stress. Wasps, they're terrible stresses for honeybee colonies, because they do keep coming back, and they come back in numbers. And I lost a colony in the autumn. It was already quite weak going into winter, and it just got hammered by the wasps, absolutely hammered. So they come in and they sort of take the bees back, and they rob the honey as well. It depends on the time of year, it's just whether they've got a sweet tooth or whether they want flesh. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, wasps aren't good. Woodpeckers, they're not good for bees. They'll drill straight through one of these, and then they'll feast on what's inside. So look at mice aren't good. If you read the really, really old literature, you can find stuff about ants, and you can find stuff about frogs, and you can find all sorts of natural enemies of bees. But there are quite a few ways you can stress a colony.
So, are there any moves to eliminate this horrible mite, chemically or any other way?
Okay,
that must be a stress on the bee.
Oh, it is. Oh, sorry, yeah. That's a stress. And the thing about this mite is that with the best...
Where does it come from, the mite? Does it come from Britain?
No, originally in Asia. Okay, so...
So it's recent.
1992 it came into the British Isles. Okay, we think now about 92. This is a stressor of honeybee colonies, and the beekeeper will apply, some beekeepers will apply chemicals, some more natural than others, to try to reduce the population of this mite in the hive. You can never really get rid of it. You can't eradicate this particular mite from colonies with any kind of chemical control. Okay, so it's very much a case of managing populations of this mite, and it is possible to manage populations of this mite, but it takes a skill and a knowledge to do it. And
I mean, does that mite go for wasps as well?
No, just honeybees. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, maybe we should bring one in from somewhere that knows about like it.
Sorry.
I thought you were going back over there.
Earlier on, you talked about the effects of climate, and I was wondering what you foresaw as the problems that bees are currently going to have given the weather that we've currently got.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's really bad news. It's kind of. There's three things that will stop a bee from flying. Okay, it's temperature. Temperature gets much below sort of 12 degrees, and the honeybees tend not to fly very well. Some native bumblebees, they fly at lower temperatures. They're less affected by low temperatures, but they'll still be affected if the temperature keeps coming down. High winds. Honeybees can't fly in high winds. Again, some bumblebees can. And what's the third one? Rain. They can't fly when it's really, really pelting down with rain. So if you add climate change to the mix, and you... honeybees love seasons. They love clear seasons. They like a proper spring. They like a proper summer. They like a proper autumn to get set up, and they like a proper winter, a nice cold winter. And if you start having climate change just erode the differences between the seasons, we lose the seasonality, we throw in lots of unsettled weather, like it's predicted we will get. You know, some people think climate change is going to be great, going to be balmy, but actually it's going to not be great from the point of view of temperatures. Then rainfall and wind, then it doesn't paint a good picture. But what I would say is that the honeybee is an amazingly adaptive creature. Okay, it has the ability to survive Arctic conditions. You know, they keep them right up in the Arctic Circle, and that's able to survive there, and it's able to survive sub-Saharan Africa. So it's got this amazing ability to survive in different environments, and I'm sure that if it has time to adapt, I'm sure that we would. And we give it the opportunity to do that properly, then I'm sure it will survive longer than the human race, is my prediction. But, okay.
Shut the back.
Is there a possibility of actually eliminating the burrow mite from the British bee population anyway, realistically?
Well, I've been working with a guy. From the States, a researcher from the States called Keith Delaplane. I don't know if you've heard of him or... But he was invited to a workshop where all the greatest minds in the world all got together to try to discuss this problem a few years ago. And he stuck his hand up and said, why aren't we thinking about ways of eradicating the mite, working as local communities to eradicate the mite? And he got laughed at for it. But I didn't see why that's such a bad idea. I think that it would take a community effort, And some facets of the beekeeping community do form groups. And then some there's some separatists as well, which tend not to want to be involved. And you would have to find a way of bringing everybody together. You know, we've talked a bit about intensive beekeeping, and we've talked a bit about sort of let alone beekeeping. And if you were to try to eradicate them, well, you'd have to bring the whole community together. And I think that would be the biggest challenge, actually.
There's no vaccine.
No, there isn't a vaccine. There's various different new chemistries that we're trying to develop. But again, it's for more, those more intensive beekeepers that might want to use them.
Isn't there a way of sort of spreading pulse that you can apply things just like with foot and mouth and so on?
I didn't hear the first part of the question, sorry.
If you've got the like EU mandatory registration of all beekeepers, that means that at least for the managed bee hives, that they're... You can then apply things just like with controls, like with foot and mouth. And
so that's right. Yeah, you could be have more of a directive approach where you say, and also you could also think about alternating sort of chemical classes as well. So the things that you might be able to, if you do get a handle on where everybody is, then you might be able to. But I think given
the wild populations, they're very.
Well, the wild populations aren't going to survive. That the thing about the wild populations is we think that they're not. But they've already gone, effectively. This feral population is just a scape-managed population. So if you can reduce the varroa in the managed population, then you'll probably concomitantly reduce it in the feral population.
Is it just spread by the bees? I mean, a bee that's got it sort of goes somewhere else and...
Yeah,
alive, but is that an intermethod of transmission?
Well, it's spread by beekeeping as well. So if you move any of these frames with brooding... Okay, so this is of young bees in here. And this mite will crawl in with sort of larval stage, and as that young larva starts to mature, then the bees cap it over. That's what these are here, these capped areas here, like a wax capping. And that's the bee pupating under there, and that's the time at which this little fella crawls out and starts feeding. So it's possible if you buy bees, or you sell bees, or you move bees, you can leave the varroamite as well. But equally, the varroamite, it's fantastic at riding on the backs of flying bees. And what happens is, bees have this innate ability to know that things aren't going right in the hive. So if you've got a beehive that's starting to collapse because of unmanaged varroa, then what happens is you get a larger and larger proportion of the mite population on the adult bees. The adult bees are mobile. And at the point at which those bees are going, oh, yes, this isn't good, is it? See if there's anywhere else we can go. And they will actually start to migrate to the stronger hives. And so they tend to jump, and they can jump acreage with the varroamite as well. So beekeepers definitely, beekeeping practices definitely would spread the mite, but also the bees have an ability to spread too. Okay.
It's not something that grooming behaviour could remove, is it?
Yeah, it is.
If you could program the bees to be very good at grooming themselves.
Yeah, that's... it's a good point that there are several traits that people in different labs around the world have tried to breed into bees. Okay, and one of those traits is grooming. It's the ability to sort of varroa sensitive hygiene, to actually go in and start
grooming each other.
There's a new product on the market, and I don't know what the efficacy is, but it's called a bee gym. And effectively, it's like scratching posts for bees. And they go in and have a little bit of a scratch. And actually, the guy has shown, I haven't seen the evidence, it's not in peer-reviewed literature, and I'm not recommending you use them. It's an interesting approach, because effectively, you get little piles of varroa stuck on sticky paper underneath the bee gym. So they do actually sort of scratch and...
Or make the varroa very tasty to bees.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Varroa is very clever, actually. It has a cloaking device. It's able to absorb and express the chemical profile of the bees that it's actually in, and this one, if say it's in with some red bees, and that's why it's red. As soon as that goes into a load of green bees, within a couple of hours it looks green to them. They can't actually tell it's there. Chemically it's inert to them. It's like another piece of their self. So it's probably only the irritation of it being in there that's getting them to go scratching. Okay, but there's another PhD student with Sheffield who's graduating now, has been looking into how that sort of chemistry works again. If we understand it, we might be able to disrupt it.
So we often see people with gear on and smoke. What is the smoke they use to stop the particle?
Okay, well the smoke is differs between beekeepers as to what's causing it, but it tends to be I tend to use either pine cones or bits of rotten wood in there, get the smoke going, and the idea is that you would, if this was a hive, you would have an entrance at the front here. And the idea is, I was taught by a very, very gentle beekeeper, and he said, you smoke the front and you leave it 3 minutes, okay? Most people smoke the front and they're in there, which is fine. So I tend to turn up at my apiary and I tend to smoke the front and then start working bees. And you sort of lay some smoke across them as you open them up. And they go, God, it's on fire, we're on fire, what are we going to do? We're going to save some honey, okay? Honey is a real important resource for them in the colony. So they go and they stock up on the honey. And then they go, oh, I'm going to sting you, and they can't physically bend over. so it makes them docile. Okay. Yeah, they're just a little bit too full to touch your toes after a three-course meal, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, it makes them docile, and they're less likely to sting.
Can I do a quick follow-up?
Yeah.
Is there any evidence that they become desensitized to smoke?
No. No, it's, I think it's kind of it must go so far back in their history when they were in trees going, oh, I can smell smoke, and we're going to go up, guys, let's get some honey and get out. And I think that's the idea.
So I'm sorry to sound naive, but probably a lot of people here haven't kept bees and wouldn't understand, like me. Presumably what you're saying is when they, their way of saving honey is to eat it, and then they can disgorge it again?
Okay, so anatomically they have something called a honey stomach. Okay, and that's a bit like a crop. that they can fill with nectar when they're collecting nectar, or honey if they're moving it in the colony. And they don't actually eat it. They just have it there, and it sits in there, and then they can go somewhere and... So who wants it now? It's actually bee sick. It is bee sick.
Can I ask, for those of us who don't keep bees, is there anything productive we can do in our gardens that would assist those who do keep bees locally?
Yes, there is. There's a lot that people can do. I think we talked a little bit about agricultural intensification and a little bit about the loss of floral diversity out there in the wider landscape. So anything that anybody can do within their gardens, even if they've got window boxes and things, to have a look at this list. I'm not a botanist, but a lot of the sorts of flowers that you want to start looking at, if you want to try to encourage all pollinators, are the sort of cottage garden plants, the lavenders. The idea is as well that they prefer sort of blue and purple flowers as well. So if you can bluebells are good, lavender's good, and sage, mint family. There's a really nice thing I found on the Tinterweb, just to answer that question. So if you're interested in what you can do, then take this piece of paper home with you. It's quite comprehensive. One of the most important things, I think, when you're looking at trying to support a pollinator community is making sure that you give them something through the year. Okay, and this is what I liked about this, actually, because it breaks things down into different time periods in the year. And it's important that pollinators have access to pollen and nectar at different times of the year. So I talked earlier about how weather can really impact the colony's ability to raise the young in the spring, because those old bees have only got so much energy in them. But one of the things they need to produce young is protein. They get their protein from pollen. So actually access to early season pollen, if you're a beekeeper, is really important. So you've got to look for the hazel tree. You've got to look for the willow tree. You've got to look for these mass sources of pollen that will get those colonies going very early in the spring. So that's why I put that on the table, actually. I think that's quite a useful guide to the green fingered amongst you. It's something that does help.
Have you got several copies of that?
Well, I actually ripped it shamelessly off the internet. So if there isn't a copy, you can have my copy anyway.
But you know, if you could give me the internet.
If you take the top, if you type in RHS Perfect for Pollinators, it'll come up. Okay.
Anything else?
Why do we import so many bees? We import a lot of bees. The commercial guys import bees because of the weather here. We don't have ideal weather conditions to generate new colonies early enough in the year to take advantage of early honey flows. So a lot of people will import bees because they need material that's been produced in a slightly earlier season in order to allow them to exploit the season here with three queen colonies. Some people import bees because they feel that the genetics of our local bee, Apis mellifera mellifera, aren't up to it when it comes to having good production, you know, being gentle on the comb, and satisfying some of those basic beekeeper needs. So some people say, well, you know, I like using Carnica because we have these races of bee on the continent. In Italy, there's a Ligurian bee, and in Germany, not surprisingly, they were very, very well organised with how they set about a breeding programme, you know, nearly 100 years ago now. So they've taken local bees, their local race, which is actually not their local race, they borrowed it from somewhere else, and they've selectively bred it to bolster all of those beekeeping traits that people want to see. So we haven't done that here, and you could say, well, actually, maybe we should be thinking about doing that here and actually encouraging our local Apis mellifera mellifera to be the next Carnica or Ligustica bee. They're the sorts of reasons. We haven't had the breeding industry here to really bring on our local bee, and so we rely on some of our European neighbours that have probably done a better job of it than we have.
I'd just like to point out to another beekeeper, I keep on getting asked about swarms, and they're not dangerous. They look really scary, and thousands of insects flying through the air in a cloud. But the point is that they don't have anything to defend. They're not defending a hive. They've got no young. They've got no honey stores. They just intend on going from A to B to serve the new home. So if you see a swarm, don't get worried. And except I wouldn't stand in the way, because I have noticed if bees get caught in your hair, they seem to think they're caught in a spider web and they're stinging. So that's not a good idea. But in general, swarms aren't a problem.
The other thing to say about swarms is that they're moving their honey stores, so their tummies are full. So same reason they can't sting as easily. So that's a good point. They're not something to be afraid of, but they certainly can be intimidating.
We're relatively new to beekeeping, and after last winter when we opened up the hive, there was a piece of comb that had got a big hole in it.
There was
a piece of the comb that had got a big hole in it.
Uh-huh.
I just wondered, is it because the bees were starving, they started eating the wax, or would it have been damaged from other animals?
Nice.
So I was like, did you put mouse guards on?
It would have had to have been a very small mouse to get in through the...
Very
near the top of the
key. If you can put...
No, it's in the middle. It was in a frame about the second or third frame in.
Sometimes bees will do it. Sometimes bees will chew through the foundation if they've been isolated in that area, they'll start using anything they can get their mandibles on. But it depends if it was reasonably neat. Then it might have been bees. If it was a little bit messy around the edges and there was a lot of stuff falling down, it's almost certainly a mouse.
It was neat.
Yeah. Yeah. So
and quite large, probably that.
Yeah, they do sometimes go through the foundation. Yeah. Yeah, I've had it before when it got
but
through the foundation.
Not through starvation.
Well, they might have been isolated for a while in that area, so they might have. And sometimes they also, rather than produce new wax, they move wax. So sometimes if you put your foundation in off to the side, they sometimes go, oh, they're wax, I'm not using it, so we'll just take a bit off there and we'll stick it somewhere else. They're great reusers of wax. Sometimes they do that.
Clearly at the moment, imports seem to be quite free. Is there are there any checks made on the quality of bees and the disease level when they're imported?
Yes, good question again. It's the exporting country's place to make sure that they're free from certain statutory notifiable diseases and pests. Okay, so it's they have to come with a local certificate to suggest that they're clear, and then when they come into this country, the bee inspection service from the bee unit will go out and then we'll check a proportion of those. We won't check every single one, but we'll check a proportion to make sure that their stocks are clean. And if we end up suspecting that there's someone importing with dodgy certification, then we will shut the whole batch and go through the whole batch. But it can be a problem when it comes, but it equally can be a problem here. Whilst we've kept these diseases to reasonably low levels, the statutory notifiable diseases, and these are bacterial diseases of the larvae, so they sort of make a mess of the larvae, make it melt down, and make it smell. It's called foul brood, two diseases that we manage actively. It is possible to get bee supplies in this country which sell bees that have got disease. So that's another problem that we have to follow. So we can sometimes end up following many hundreds of sales from an apiary that had disease. So it's not just outside, it's also bee movements inside as well, the country.
And is there any kind of disease that bees get where you as a beekeeper would notice that they were a bit off colour, but then they can recover? In other words, is there a bee equivalent to getting a short dose of flu?
There's a plethora of things that will cause certain symptoms. Sometimes they do sort themselves out, and sometimes they either need intervention to be sorted out, or sometimes it's downhill all the way. So, but there's loads of different things. There's viruses which will cause lethargy. There's mites which make this thing look like a behemoth, actually. tiny little mites, tracheal mites, that live in the breathing tubes of the bees. Okay, so they can have symptoms associated with them, sort of lethargy. I think we picked lethargy up on one of the...
Laziness,
wasn't it? Yeah, but they look lazy. They look like lethargic. And because they can't breathe properly, they can't... Mm. Sort of, respiration's affected. There's loads and loads of things. There's chronic bee paralysis virus, which does something similar. There's so many things. When you talk about diarrhea, there's certain... The gut parasites that tend to aggravate the gut walls can... lead to sort of producing diarrhea, and the bees are usually very clean. They usually go outside and use the toilet outside rather than doing it in the hive. And sometimes if they get a gut parasite going, sometimes that can increase their chance of soiling in the hive. So there's loads of them. There's loads of information on our website, which you could look at if you're interested in these things.
You probably know, but maybe not everybody knows, why the Victorians used to paint a bee at the bottom of the loo. It's a pun on the Latin, apis.
I was going to say something to aim at, yeah.
That's right, with a bee, apis.
Yeah.
Does it help talking to bees?
Pardon?
Does it help to talk to bees?
You have to.
I don't think so. It doesn't stop me doing it, but I do.
You talked about the different diseases that bees have. Do the bees have a mechanism, if a bee dies actually in the hive, of removing the remains?
Yes. Now, you sometimes see, if you're a beekeeper, you sometimes see dead bees being carried out. Because, I mean, bees are going to die. They're reasonably short-lived. They're either going to die in the hive or away from the hive. And you do see them. If they die in the hive, they'll sometimes... they're not ceremonious about it or anything. Sometimes they'll take out a whole bee and fly off, and you can see them flying off and sort of throwing this dead bee away from the hive. Sometimes they'll just rip them down. Okay, so they'll literally just start tearing the bits off them, and you can see them falling through. We often have these open mesh floors in order to help these varroa mites fall through the mesh floors. It's supposed to help a bit, part of integrated pest management for the mites. And you can find wings and legs and antennae and all things that have fallen down through the mesh. They're quite unceremonious about it. If a bee colony, because of problems with weather, is starting to starve, the source of protein it has access to is its young. So it will eat its young. And it will then feed some of its young back to slightly older young, that it thinks he might get through the period of dearth and bring through the next generation. So they're not unceremonious. They've evolved from wasps. So they've evolved from carnivorous wasps, and they've turned into vegetarians. And they'll preferentially be vegetarians, but they will have a munch.
Okay, I think if that's everything, we'll draw the formal bit to a close. We're going to be here for a good 20 minutes clearing up, so do feel free to ask Giles anything else that you like. Just to kind of look ahead a little bit, I've said already once this year, but say it again, that next month, which is also on the 11th of the month, being the second Tuesday, which is always our day, will coincide with Oxfordshire Science Festival Week. We will have a listing on their website, and that means that you can expect quite a lot of people who wouldn't normally think of coming to the Science Cafe to come. The topic is carbon dioxide capture and the chemistry of it. The speaker is Dermot O'Hare from the chemistry department a few metres away. And, if you are planning to come to that, then please, early warning, I would suggest you get here a little earlier. I will say quietly to people here that we might consider opening up the doors at 2:45 if we can get our act together for next month for our regulars so they can grab good seats. If it gets full, what we will do is do overspill in there, and there'll be benches and space for people to sit there and use the other screen to look at. But I'd like to obviously fit in as many people as we possibly can without it getting too crowded to be able to exit fast if there is a fire. So that's for next month, and the other dates and looking ahead are all on the website. But as I said, it's the second Tuesday of the month, so if you want to come again, that's the date to put in your diary. The only month we have off is August, because our first year of regulars said, can we have a rest, please, so we can go away and not miss anything. And that's what we do every year. But at the moment, we're looking to be staying in here indefinitely, so it's same time, same month, same day of the month. And the same venue.
Could I just add one thing? Feel free to take home any of the literature that was put on the tables for you. But all of the stuff I passed around, if you can make sure you leave that.
Bring that, can you bring that, it back to the front table here?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
If you haven't had a look already, then the website is a good place to see, and the email I sent around today has a link to how to subscribe and indeed unsubscribe if you're moving or no longer interested. All of that's automated. Thank you very much to the museum for hosting us, of course, and to Zoe for being around. She's lurking outside to make sure we all get out safely. Thank you very much to all my helpers. Thank you very much to OBN for sponsoring, and the biggest thanks to all to Giles for a fantastic evening.